Right, the tape's rolling.
Glad to hear it. Hello, I'm Simon Mercer. This is Crave, the podcast dedicated to film, music, theatre, television, anything that's been entertaining Steve McCabe and I lately.
And we have a hearty midwinter mix for everyone this week. We've got live music, we've got live shows, we've got films.
We have. We've both pondered how good the bad guys are in Suicide Squad.
And the answer is not very. Sorry, spoilers there, really. Actually, so they spoiled the film the moment they made it. Sorry.
You digress.
Starting already, yeah. Yeah, I've had a couple of nights out for live music, very, very different ones. I've seen a show celebrating the music of John Lennon, and I've seen Selena Gomez.
Ooh, you couldn't get more contrasting pieces of entertainment, I suspect.
No, one of those was good.
Yeah, let me guess. I have also been out and about, not to such, it has to be said, big names in the entertainment business, at least not yet. But you might recall I interviewed a few weeks back an aspiring young Auckland singer-songwriter called Miller. He'd only just put out his first EP. Well, he's since then performed his first live show with a full band, which I caught, and I'll tell you about a bit later on.
Yes, it's nice to see Crave promoting and sponsoring upcoming talent, isn't it?
That's part of the reason why we're here. And we get out and about and see all these people, which is quite nice.
Yes. Speaking of getting out and about, I've been to see slightly more established talent. I saw the new John le Carré adaptation, the film Our Kind of Traitor.
Oh, I'm looking forward to hearing about that. Do you know, my mum had a library of just about every John le Carré novel ever written.
That's quite impressive.
She really liked him. I think she said he was getting a bit formulaic towards the end of the more latter novels. But
yes.
The first batch she thought were thoroughly, thoroughly entertaining. Anyway, I digress now. And I also want to tell you that about a film I have seen lately. It's getting a lot of publicity around the country. It's the story of one of the most successful New Zealand pop songs ever. I'm talking about the feature documentary called Poi Air. And I will have some good things to say about that.
Excellent.
Now,
before we go any further, it's worth mentioning that you'll find lots more details of everything we're talking about on our website, cravepodcast.com. There's links, obviously, to the for previous episodes. We've got written reviews, loads of photos of recent concerts, and lots of information about what's up and coming in the Auckland and the Greater New Zealand area.
Right, it's just packed with goodness, that website, Steve.
Isn't it?
Now, let's get into the film, which has to be said, quite clearly, most, if not all, critics around the world have loathed it, but it's selling lots of tickets. This is Suicide Squad. It's the latest superhero film from DC, which means it's the latest in this sort of, I suppose we'd call it a sparring match between the two big superhero companies, DC and Marvel. Steve, I'm going to pass the baton to you and you can attempt to tell us what the story's about. You lucky devil.
No, I'm losing the will to live already. I mean, seriously, you just don't want to have to think about it any longer than you have to, do you?
Go on, I did.
Okay, so let's see. The story is, and it's actually interestingly set up, one of the few good things about the film is the way that the story is set up at the beginning. The idea is that you've got a group of the worst of the worst criminals locked away in various prisons around America. Some apparently have superpowers, some are simply very, very talented in what they do, some are just extraordinarily evil. There's very little coherence to what's going on, and that's sort of emblematic of the film in general. And so it is decided that they will be assembled as what they end up being referred to as a suicide squad of the worst, who will be on call in case, because remember, as you said, this is part of the DC universe, and Superman is now dead.
Yes.
So Viola Davis plays a character named Amanda Waller. She's by far the best actress in the entire film. With little competition, to be fair. But she plays a high-up CIA operative who's trying to pitch this squad that's going to be able to defend America from future metahumans who might not be quite as benevolent as Superman.
Yes, indeed.
And so the beginning of the film is, in fact, her pitch as she's introducing these various characters.
Yeah. Yeah.
And explaining what they could bring to the table, why you would want to put them in this squad. And so, you know, I don't think it's a huge spoiler to say that the squad is assembled, is deployed.
Yes.
And hilarious consequences ensue.
We won't have to give away too much of the plot. I mean, they're presented with a sort of otherworldly villain, and yet another villain, catch a villain to send a villain to catch a villain, threat to encounter. I agree with you, Steve, that I thought it's the start of it was quite promising. They got on with it. They didn't muck around with introducing the characters first off. And I wrote down a few little notes in my pad, as I want to do, and I did write down Deadpool at one point early on, where I thought, oh, this felt like some sort of a attempt perhaps to match or rival that sort of the R-rated Deadpool movie from Marvel that we both liked some months ago. And, you know, it
Indeed.
Had coarser language, this film, didn't it, than the Superman-Batman film. It was probably more violent, more graphically violent. It had a grittier feel to begin with.
Yes.
But I think the whole trick of the film to really work is, A, do you believe these bad guys are really bad? And then B, if you do believe that, how do you pull off the trick of making them act in a way which effectively is heroic? And I personally, I don't think they manage that. I made a note, especially for me anyway, with an actor like Will Smith, who plays Deadshot, because he can't play a bad guy, Steve. He's too good to play a bad guy. It's just he's meant to be this assassin who just murders people left, right, and centre, but he cares deeply about his young daughter at the same time. It's just very confused, and I don't know. He's just I've seen him in too many good guy movies to really believe him as a bad guy, I guess.
I think that's reasonable. Yeah, I mean, basically, he's got a lovely screen presence, but you know, we were talking the other week about Independence Day, which he was in the original
yes.
version of, and I remarked that alongside him was Jeff Goldblum, who plays Jeff Goldblum.
Yes, yes.
And I think, to be fair, much could be said the same way of Will Smith. In the end, basically, he kind of plays himself, doesn't he? He's got this lovely stage presence.
He's likable. You're right.
Very likable, very warm, very engaging. But essentially, that's what he does. And you can imagine in any casting call, it's like, okay, who would you like me to play myself as this time?
Yes, that's right.
And he plays himself as Deadshot, yeah. And so he's conflicted. You're right. He's an assassin with a heart of gold because he's got a teenage daughter.
Yeah.
Now he actually has a backstory,
yes.
And he's the first one they introduce. The second one they introduce is Harley Quinn.
Yes.
Margot Robbie's wonderfully overamped and overegged and over everythinged comic relief.
Yes.
And I'd say there's a decent relationship between those two on stage. Margot Robbie clearly was having fun making this film.
Yes, yes.
She's the only one who was aware it was a comedy.
I think you're right. Yeah, and to be fair, she gets a juicy role of not only being a central character in the ensemble of the Suicide
yes.
Squad, but also having this other relationship which comes in and out of the telling of this film with the Joker.
Do we really have to mention the Joker? Can we not just gloss over him?
We can.
I'd rather not. You know, let's do it. He was crap. He was absolutely awful.
Jared Leto is the actor.
Dear Lord.
Well, I don't know. Was he on a hiding to nothing, though? How could any actor who takes on the Joker is forever and a day going to be held up against the performance of Heath Ledger in that Batman film? Even though a number of years have passed since that performance, probably even now you'd say a hard act to follow.
No, you're absolutely right. But, you know, he put his hand up for it.
He did.
And so we're going to judge him.
And you judge him harshly.
Well, deservedly so. I mean, first of all, the character was underwritten to begin with. And he didn't do very much with it. He tried to overact his way through
it. Yes, he did.
And I felt it just came across as honkingly embarrassing. It just didn't work. You could see what he was shooting for. He was trying very hard in many ways to be another Heath Ledger. And I think the key there is...
Tried.
I mean, here's an analogy for you. After the Beijing Olympics, everyone said, how on earth will London follow their opening ceremony? it was incredible. How do you top that? And the answer is, you don't attempt to. You go in a completely opposite,
yes,
different direction. And that's what London did. And as a result, they played a blinder. And was it better or was it worse? You can't say, because you can't compare the two. They were separate.
Yes, yes.
That's what Jared Leto should have tried to have done with his Joker here. And instead, he thought, how can I out Heath Ledger the late Heath Ledger? And the answer is you can't.
No. I do agree with that. I agree he needed to find another way in, and he just tried to just amp it up even more. Can I just mention one thing quickly about Margot Robbie and Harley Quinn? Because I know this has attracted some attention in other reviews, but how could you not notice it? I mean, she's the central female character. She's skimpily clad all the time. And it has to be said, her hot pants are in just about every second shot. And was it sexist? Yes. But I thought it happened so much, Steve, it felt like a parody after a while. It was almost like, here comes the gratuitous hot pants shot. Did you think that, or was it just a blatant attempt to entice the male audience? I don't know.
Her ass should have had separate billing.
Yes, I'm...
We saw that much of it. And yes, it was absolutely... It was to give the teenage boys in the audience something to get hot and bothered about when they got home. No, it was grossly sexist. It was overdone. Margot Robbie is a very attractive woman. Yeah. She's gorgeous, let's be honest, and she has a very nice ass. It doesn't mean that we have to be shown it every 30 seconds.
Yeah, it was overdone to the extent that it became a joke on itself, really, and I don't think it actually helped the film in the end.
No, not at all. Because she had a well-written character that she played phenomenally. She was a very entertaining presence. She was without doubt the most enjoyable thing on in the film. I really enjoyed watching her. They didn't need to do that. She's a bit of eye candy as well, but that suddenly became the focus. It was more important that she was all hot and sexy and less important that she was actually really quite funny.
Yeah.
But do you remember early on when they were setting the scene? This is way early in the film, so we're not doing any spoilers here. But Batman,
yes,
Ben Affleck's Batman, rescues Harley Quinn from a car crash under the water.
That's right.
And you remember that scene then makes me think that, to answer your previous question, yes, it was hideously sexist the way she was portrayed. If you notice the way that Batman then proceeded to try and help her, you could write it off as simple CPR.
Yes.
I'm saying it was the rapiest CPR I've ever seen.
Okay.
Didn't sit well.
Yeah. Now, just on the comedic reference to this, Steve, one other note I made in my pad, and I think you've mentioned this in your own review, and we both agreed on this, that as the film kicks into the middle and latter stages, I don't give too much away, but there's a character called the Enchantress who becomes the central sort of villain in this. And
that's Cara Delevingne, isn't it?
And there are scenes where she's assuming her full power, and there's all sorts of effects involved, and not only about her in her person, but above the skies of New York City. And, you know, just a few weeks back, we were talking about Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
I wrote down Ghostbusters on my pad because just thought, oh, no, this is it. It's got that sort of taking on that sort of supernatural element in it. I'm sure it was a comic. To me, it was a comic. It became quite comical. I'm sure the writers weren't wanting it to be comical, but having just seen Ghostbusters not that long ago, my mind couldn't help but go there, which is perhaps a bit unfortunate.
Are you referring to the great big donut of rubbish that encircled the building?
Yeah, that, yes. And then her form changes, and there's mists, colourful mists and clouds around her, and her voice changes, and it's almost like she's going to spout green goo from her mouth or something. It's
wearing some sort of bizarre swimsuit stroke evening dress.
Yes.
And she summons her demons by dancing around like a bored stripper or something. Awful.
Yeah. But for all our criticism, Steve, let's just think. I think there's a lot not to like about it. I think it was, for me, I did enjoy it more than the Batman versus Superman movie, but maybe that's not saying much. I don't know. But it has done quite well around the world in terms of popular attendance. So why would that, you know, why? What is the great movie going public getting out of this film? Is it?
I think your reference to Deadpool earlier in our little chat here speaks volumes. I think that that's what DC were trying to do with this. They've seen things like Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah, yeah.
And they've seen Deadpool, and they thought, okay, take the slightly B-list characters, take the sort of the anti-heroes, and let's see what we can do with them. And that's what they were trying to pitch it as, I think. And famously, as this film was being flogged, and it has been flogged mercilessly, relentlessly, the publicity for this film has been overwhelming. They released a number of trailers, each of which depicted a very, very different film. Some of them were quite dark and noirish, and you can see elements of that in the final product.
Yeah.
Some of them were the comedy that's got Margot Robbie in it. Some of them actually involve characters, and if you remember, you don't actually get to see characters until there's one scene toward the end in a bar. That's in the trailer, although worth noting that the scene that's actually in the trailer, the actual dialogue in the trailer, doesn't appear in the film.
Okay.
But they released that, and then people started to think, oh, this is a comedy. So then apparently they actually rewrote and reshot big chunks of it to make it into the comedy that people were expecting.
Ah, God.
So it's had enormous publicity. Some of it's been quite misleading. Nobody in DC ever truly knew what this film was going to be, and it's a complete dog's breakfast.
It is. You know, that's, you just, can I just pick you up on one point there, Steve, before we move on?
Go ahead.
Because you just talked about the promotion of the film, and I always wonder, you know, you can go to various websites and you can check what the production budget of a film is. So in this film, Suicide Squad, according to Mojo.com, the production budget was $175 million, which is a big budget. So far, as of earlier today, around the world, it had earned $384 million, so more than double. But I'm sure the production budget doesn't include what they have to spend on promoting the thing, which could be many, many, many millions. I have no idea. I always wonder how you actually work out whether a film's made any money or not. There must be some formula.
My understanding is a very, very, very crude rule of thumb.
Yeah.
You expect to see a film double its budget to break even.
Okay.
Double its production budget.
Okay, so that it has made some money then. Okay.
It's probably made its money back. But what I've been reading is that initially, in its first weekend, it sold a million. I mean, everyone wanted to go and see it because, well, it's Suicide Squad, isn't it? As soon as word got out, and it's not critics that people are listening to, it's their mates who saw it last night.
Yeah.
Word got out that this is a pile of nonsense.
Right.
And my understanding is that what started out with enormous take very, 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 very quickly declined as people started to realise that it wasn't just snotty, overly intellectual, critical critics who were panning it. It was people who actually liked this kind of film who were saying that it can't decide what it is. I mean, look at the way that the characters are developed. I have to have a rant about this. I'm sorry. At the beginning, we said, you know, Will Smith's character, Deadshot, gets built up quite nicely.
Yes.
They spend a long time dwelling on Harley Quinn.
Yeah.
They then give us a quick tickle around at, what's his name? The fire dude. Diablo, thank you. I knew you'd remember for me. We got a very quick insight into him. Not much at all. Then we got 30 seconds of Boomerang. His superpower is he's Australian, which I wasn't aware was a superpower.
Yeah.
And then that's it. That's all the character we get. This character called Killer Croc, who is apparently a human crocodile. Mm. And we've got no idea why he's a human crocodile, but it comes in useful at the end, but they never tell us. Then there's another member of the Suicide Squad. You know the one who they actually used to demonstrate that the neck implants work? Tell me his name.
Oh, yeah. I can't.
You can't. Because he was never even introduced. No. It was this guy. Oh, yeah, and the other one that we can't even be bothered mentioning.
Yeah.
Then also, there's another very interesting character who I would have liked to have known an awful lot more about. The civilian... Oh, not civilian. The on the side of the Angels handler of the Suicide Squad, Rick Flag, played by Joel Kinnaman.
Yes. Yep.
Who is just, everything is very gruff and very tough and very intense. And that's all he does because that's his character. But he, for some reason that we're never told about, has a kind of a henchman called Katana.
Right, yes, the female samurai. you like.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. Who is on Rick Flagg's side? Who the hell was she?
I don't know. There was some brief reference to her, but it was just in one line of script, and I don't recall it now. Yeah. So yeah.
And she apparently has got this sword that contains the souls of everyone that she's killed. Now, there's an interesting character. So we get to know virtually nothing about her. There were so many opportunities to do things with characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm ranting here, aren't I?
You are. It's all right.
Seriously, they deserve to be ranted at.
So to answer the quintessential question, would you recommend buying a ticket? I think your answer is no.
As I've said about other films in the past, I got a free press screening ticket. I still want my money back.
Okay, I'll be just a little bit different for you in that I think there are some people who just have no interest in these types of superhero movies at all. And if you're one of those people, for goodness sake, don't go and see it. You're not going to get anything out of it. If you've been someone who has followed these films for a while, I suspect your curiosity factor is going to be quite high, Steve. And I think you probably would want to see it. And I wouldn't say don't go and see it, because I think it's just there's this developing universe that's going along and we're trying to see where the hell it's going to go. Will DC start to get any better? It doesn't look like it, but maybe they will one day. I'm slightly middling on a recommendation. But if you've never been to any of these films, then I wouldn't choose this one as the one to start with, that's for sure.
Oh, Simon, you're going soft in your middle age, mate.
I probably am. Or maybe I've always been like that. Oh, my gosh. Hey, Steve, can we change tack just a bit and ask...
Oh, please, I'm begging you.
Hey, let's talk about some live entertainment. And let's start with you, because you've been to a couple of really contrasting shows. The first one...
I have indeed.
The first one, this is interesting, I think the billing of it said it was a part concert but also a part biography.
Yes.
Or that John Lennon.
Indeed. Now... This was a very, very interesting production. What's left to say about someone like John Lennon? I mean, everything's been said. So it's not what needs to be said that matters. It's the way it's said, I think, that made Through a Glass Onion a really quite an entertaining production. It was put on, it's still playing, actually, if anyone wants to go and see it, at the Civic in Auckland, which is a lovely venue to begin with. You sit down in the Civic and you think, yeah, something good's about to happen.
That's true.
And so John Watson is the fellow who... originated this production, and he's been touring it on and off since the 90s, early 90s.
Okay.
And it's a very, very simple thing. He stands at a microphone, and he becomes John Lennon. He takes on Lennon's voice reasonably well. There are moments when he descends into slightly caricatured scouts.
Yeah.
But for the most part, you know, he's telling the story of John Lennon and how he grew up in Liverpool, which is, you know, so as I say, he overdoes the accent a little bit. But he is John Lennon telling the story of his briefly of his childhood and then his time in the Beatles. And then obviously Yoko gets mentioned. And since this is being told from John Lennon's point of view.
Yeah.
Because it's obviously, ostensibly, it's Lennon telling the story. Yoko is viewed very, very favourably, obviously.
Yes.
So, for that matter, is the only other Beatle who gets mentioned.
Oh.
Yes, apparently there were two Beatles, according to this story.
Now, are you going to tell me that it's not McCartney?
No, it is, actually.
He's going to go for Harrison or something. Okay.
No, he mentions Paul very briefly and mentions the fact that... they were best of mates, and that's why it was okay for them to squabble sometimes. You know, fairly shallow and superficial, but reasonably worth mentioning.
Yeah.
But what made it work really well was the way he sort of wove in and out of the songs. So he would discuss briefly something about Lennon's politics, and the politics were expected of the Beatles. And then he and his pianist would start playing Revolution.
Okay.
Or he would discuss the bizarreness of the lyrics that he wrote as he realised it didn't all have to be, I love you, I love you.
Yeah.
And he could write what the hell he wanted. And so they played Come Together.
Right, yeah.
Which I have to tell you, many, many years ago in a previous life, I was teaching English as a foreign language in Japan. Yeah. And I had one adult student who was, frankly, somewhat annoying. And after he kept mithering me for free lessons. And one day he asked me, are there any... I am a big fan of the Beatles. What song should I listen to learn English? So I told him to get hold of the lyrics for Come Together. And he never bothered me again.
Like I still remember that line. It stays with me for decades, I guess. There's one line and come towards the end of Come Together when he sings, he's got to be good looking because he's so hard to see.
Beautiful.
It's a lovely line. It's a lovely line, yeah. Hey, just one question, Steve, because when I was talking the other week about Billy Crystal, which, again, was also very simple, just him and a prompter just talking to the audience about his career, but he did intersperse it with video. Was there anything like that in this show at all?
No, in fact, exactly the opposite. It was utterly stripped down and naked. Right. It was your man Watson standing at a microphone stand, occasionally picked up a guitar, one spotlight on him, one dimmer light on the pianist next to him, sitting at a grand piano, and a completely black backdrop. And that was it. It was utterly Spartan.
Wow. Was it like an hour and a half? What did it feel like?
All up, I think it was about a little over an hour and a half with about a 15-minute interval in the middle.
Gosh.
So it was effective. To begin with, I was thinking, where on earth are they going with this? By the end of it, I was thinking, that was brilliant.
Oh, nice. Well, isn't that really kind of refreshing that you can achieve that with just, as you say, one bloke, a microphone, a little bit of instrumentation. But if the story is a good story and it's well written, then that's what you need.
Well, he's got a great story. Apparently, it's based on interviews with Lennon, his writings, and obviously your man's added his own linking material.
Yeah.
But the whole thing holds together beautifully. It sounds like it should be a little bit crap. It actually holds together way better than you'd imagine, and really quite effective. So it's playing in Auckland for about another week, I believe. Okay. It's definitely worth looking at.
Yeah, I think the key thing there is... if I'd seen that, I might have thought, like you said at the very beginning, Steve, I think I've read and seen so much about John Lennon. Am I going to gain? What am I going to get out of this? But it's the telling. It's in the telling, isn't it?
It is. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So now listen, the Beatles, of whom Mr. Lennon was a member, were well used, in particularly early on in their career, to something that we came to know around the world as Beatlemania. I understand your next concert had some sort of mania attached to it, but perhaps not of the quality of the Beatles. Could you explain?
Yeah, we shan't dwell on this too long because we're kind of alternating between rubbish and good stuff, and we're back to the kind of the rubbish again, which is a little bit of a statement. I went to see Selena Gomez last night,
and you're still standing. That's good.
I'm still standing. Other people weren't actually by the end of the evening. Now this Selena Gomez, because I'm sure you're already aware of all of this, obviously, Simon. I'm sure you're a big fan. You got all her LPs at home. But for those of us who aren't familiar, was sort of a Disney princess, I guess, eventually spun off into her own career because she's dead pretty. And now, because this is what her minders and handlers have decided, is now going to start being a grown-up talent in her own right. And so she's got this new album out called Revival. And so last night she came to New Zealand for the first time. Mm-hmm. And played in Auckland at the Vector Arena to a crowd of 10,000 people, about 9,976 of which were late teen girls.
you felt right at home.
Oh, it's totally where I belong. Yeah, yeah. It was Beatlemanic at times. My wife and daughter were. They're both actually quite like her. Actually, what they really like was the opening act, DNCE, who I shall mention in a little more detail in a moment. But they got their tickets and we were way down in the mosh pit, which is where they love to be for concerts, except for last night. They said they enjoyed the show. They hated where they were. People were getting crushed. People were falling over. People were collapsing and being wheeled out by St. John's Ambulance.
Oh, my God.
It was a mess. In fact, before she even came on stage, the venue management made a PA announcement saying, would everyone please step back because people are getting crushed.
Goodness me.
At the front of the stage. And of course, when people did step back, all the people just filled the vacuum that they left. It was apparent. My wife put a video on her Facebook account of her trying to film the show and being shoved around, jostled around. She couldn't hold the camera straight. It was, by all accounts, a mess. Now, I was obviously with the photographers, and we weren't even allowed in the photo pit at the front of the stage where photographers usually go. We were sent back to the sound desk.
Yeah.
So we couldn't really see all of this. But what we did hear was the most horrendous screaming just when the PA announcement came. We said, ladies and gentlemen, and suddenly a barrage of screams went up. And we thought, oh, dear, this isn't going to be good. And the show itself was a little bit rubbish. It was slick. You know, I say about the John Lennon show, it was almost naked in its production. This was the exact opposite. Right. Young Miss Gomez comes on stage with, I'm guessing probably close to a dozen dancers surrounding her.
Right.
Apparently there were four or five costume changes during the course of the evening. There was a band, but you could barely see them. They were basically silhouetted at the edge of the stage because it's not about the music.
Right.
It's absolutely not about the music. It's about this extraordinarily well-presented and fairly pretty young lady with astonishing hair who is made up to and polished within an inch of her life. Frankly, she looks like a cross between a China doll and a Gerry Anderson marionette.
Oh, that's quite an apt. I can picture that. Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to picture it, don't forget there's a photo gallery at the crave.podcast.com website.
I'll be rushing there as soon as this is over.
I'll bet you will be. But no, it was just. She went through the motions, she really did, and she does them very well. But you can tell she's just got the word product stamped all over her. What was much better, what was vastly, vastly superior, was the support act, a bunch called DNCE.
Okay.
Who, as far as I can tell, reading up about them a little bit, they're basically, essentially a novelty act, really. You remember the Jonas Brothers? I'm sure you were a huge fan of theirs.
Yes, I don't, not with a lot of intimate detail, but I know of the Jonas Brothers.
Yeah. Well, the DNCE is led by a Jonas brother.
Okay.
Joe, apparently. Right. And it's his little, basically his band. And you can tell they're just having fun. Yeah. They're having a fantastic time, and that just bleeds over into the performance. They are having a scream. They're having a great time. And as a result, so is the audience.
Yeah, it helps.
It's just simple power pop done really, really well.
Good.
Four good musicians who know how to play, know how to put on a show. They don't need dancers and costume changes and all that kind of nonsense. They need good tunes, and that's what they've got. They've got a few good tunes of their own. They do a bit of Prince, they do a bit of Queen, and they're fun.
Yeah. Oh, great.
So if you ever see Selena Gomez playing again, save your money. Wait till DNCE come back, because if they come back to town, I'll be there. I really enjoyed
them. Stuff. Okay, well, that's a good recommendation. I wasn't going to be rushing out to see Selena Gomez, and I certainly won't now, but thank you.
Now, I can't imagine you completely your cup of tea.
No.
She didn't do any Bruce Springsteen covers. Apparently, she did a Eurythmics cover badly.
Okay. Not everyone can do a good Springsteen cover. Okay, right.
I gather you can, though.
Oh, I've had my moments. But we won't get into it right now.
too modest, Simon.
Oh, here's my guitar. Oh, hold on. No, we'll save that for another time. Now, Steve, I want to tell you about one show I've been to see, which is really, you know, you're talking about Selena Gomez and a show about Lennon. This is, you know, people who are already established or well-known around the world. But this is this young chap. I interviewed him on we played the interview in our podcast a few weeks back. This is this Auckland singer-songwriter called Miller.
And yes, this was back in episode 20.
Way back then.
Back in June.
Yes, and he'd just put out his first EP, which was called Shoot Me in the Heart. Now, he's been a solo performer for a little while around Auckland, but just in the last week or two, he's performed for the first time with a full band. And I went along to see it because I was interested to see what his music sounded like live with the backing of several musicians, and it was a very, you're talking about 10,000 people at the Vector, Steve. This is a little bar in Ponsonby Road called the Golden Dawn, a sliver of a bar on quite a bleak winter's night, and probably you'd fit comfortably 20, 30 people.
Oh, wow.
That many. And but as he got into it, there probably might have been 50 there, but I guess the point of it was an opportunity for the band to go through and in public do their stuff. And I really enjoyed it. So just to very quickly recap, these are, I suppose you'd say he's a folky ballady poppy type of performer. He's written his stuff. He's got a nice ear for a melody. A lot of the songs, all the songs in the EP, he plays all the instruments. He's got a reasonably, he's got a nice turn of phrase with his lyrics and his song "Shoot Me in the Heart." There's a reference to religion, where he says, "Praise the Lord and thank God for ammunition," which I thought, when I heard that, I thought about all the recent events in the United States, and it seemed like an apt line. It's just interesting to hear a song in a stripped down version, and then to hear it with other instruments, adding other complexities and depth to the performance. And it worked well. He had a nice band. There's four other musicians: drummer, lead guitar, bass, and a backing vocal percussion person as well. Miller himself, apart from playing sort of an acoustic guitar, he added some lead guitar and keyboards as well.
Oh, wow.
So most of the songs are still slow to mid tempo, and I actually, to be fair, with especially with the drummer, I kind of, when there were some faster tempo songs, I probably started to enjoy it a bit more. It felt like the band was really kicking in. He's got quite a sweet voice. It's not a gutsy voice yet. He's still a young guy, but I just kind of think he's the sort of bloke who, if he can stick with it, he's got enough talent about how to write a song that he could be around in the industry for a long time. I think he could. I think as the band gets more gigs under its belt, it'll be well worth checking out. And I did enjoy it. I made a note at one point when they were just getting into a rockier part of a song, when it was a bit more up-tempo and there was a sort of a choppy rhythm guitar going, and I made a note, it reminded me a little bit of a Tom Petty sort of a song. So early days. Early days. He's got quite a nice soulful backing singer called Bonnie Horonui, who added a sort of a soul bluesy feel to it. And I actually would be quite interested, this is my personal view, to hear him maybe move away a little bit from that folk pop sort of style of vocal to a slightly grittier song singing. I'd be interested to hear how he got on with that. But anyway, I would recommend it absolutely.
Well, you sold me. I'll definitely look out for next time.
I don't think he's... you get the sense that he's, we're just witness to a young chap learning about his craft as a songwriter, and I'm sure it'll develop as it goes along. But I think what I'll do, Steve, is just keep an eye out whether there are any more gigs coming up, and we'll make a note of them on our website. And if you get a chance, it's definitely worth checking him out. So a tick from me. Now.
Sounds good.
Yeah, I think so. I'm going to also mention at the end of the podcast an interesting link between Miller and the last item we're going to talk about. This is my history of segues. But before that, can you please tell me, because I am interested in John le Carré's work, about this latest film that you've seen, another spy thriller based on another spy thriller he wrote.
Right, this is Our Kind of Traitor.
Lovely title.
Yeah, it was press screened about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah,
quite some time ago. Just opened this week in New Zealand, and it's, as you say, it's a John le Carré adaptation. And rather unfortunately, all John le Carré adaptations will now be viewed through the lens of Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy.
Yeah,
and that's now the gold standard against which they'll all be judged. And unfortunately, Our Kind of Traitor would have been better to have been made before that, because unfortunately it doesn't hold up half as well. The basic story is Ewan McGregor plays a youngish professional type who's in a sort of a failing marriage with Naomi Harris, who's a well-established international lawyer. They're off on holiday somewhere in North Africa, and one evening, he finds himself in a bar with Dima, played by Stellan Skarsgård.
Okay.
And gets sucked into conversation with Dima, who is some sort of Russian mafioso type, and is then prevailed upon to fetch a memory stick, a USB stick, back into the UK when he returns to England.
Right.
He's then picked up at customs. And MI5 want to know everything about what's going on. And they then have him basically play Dima for them. He's then their operative,
right,
working Dima.
Right.
And that's basically, you know, the setup as it goes. Ewan McGregor, I am increasingly of the opinion, is one of the most fortunate actors working in Hollywood today.
Right, okay.
I don't quite know how he keeps getting these top,
yeah,
roles. Because,
okay,
he's very, very, very rudimentary as an actor. Which is unfortunate when you put people like Naomi Harris next to him, because she's brilliant.
Is that the Naomi Harris who was the new Moneypenny?
The very fellow. She's fantastic.
Right, yes.
And obviously, you know, she acts him off the screen, as indeed do Damian Lewis.
Ah, right.
And Mark Gatiss as the two MI5 handlers.
Okay.
Who work him. And those two are absolutely brilliant together. You know, without doubt, the high point of the film. Mark Gatiss gets to be his old northern self. We've been used to seeing him in Sherlock lately, being all sort of reptilian as Mycroft Holmes.
Right.
He gets to be just a proper good northern bloke, even though he's very high up in MI5, and it's fantastic. He's clearly enjoying himself and doing a brilliant job with it. But all the way through, I kept wanting to shout at Ewan McGregor's character, "What the hell do you think you're doing? Don't do it! No! Why are you doing this? Walk away! You're a fool!" And the entire film is premised on him doing something stupid.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And
it could wear a bit thin after a while.
Well, it is. It's just you can't believe that somebody as seemingly intelligent and sophisticated and worldly wise as this bloke would consistently keep on making such foolish decisions. And I mean, I understand, you know, it's Stellan Skarsgård. You don't say no to him. I get
that.
But there are numerous occasions when he could have said, "Yeah, I'm out now." And he repeatedly doesn't, and you're wondering, why not? Why doesn't he walk away? And that, for me, is the fatal flaw of the film. That it's enough of a deal-breaker that while you have got fantastic talent in this film, obviously it's based on superb source material,
yeah,
that one thing, for me, was enough of a stumbling block that I'd almost go as far as to say it almost ruined it for me. Not quite, because the film is beautifully directed by Susanna White. It looks fantastic.
Right.
It's lovely to watch. It's a very, very beautifully shot film. It's very, very well made.
Yes.
The director of photography is a chap named Anthony Dodd Mantle. He's done everything from, you know, he did Rush, the motor racing film. He did Slumdog Millionaire.
Okay.
He knows how to make a film look,
yes,
good.
Okay.
And there's no, and this looks great. So focus on what you're seeing, less so much on what you're hearing, and you'll enjoy it.
Okay, fair enough. Very good. I'm not sure I'm going to rush out to see that one or not. But I would recommend to you, if you get the opportunity, the New Zealand feature-length documentary called Poi Air. Poi Air was the name of a pop song, which was very, very successful and in this country, Steve, before you arrived here. This is about 83, 84 we're talking about.
Yes, it's before my time, isn't it,
yeah,
really?
And it surprised lots of people when it got to number one in this country, and it stayed there for several weeks. It basically was a song which combined the talents of a professional Māori singer who was kind of a soul singer called Dalvanius Prime.
Great
wonderful
name.
And he combined with a local Māori performing arts club from a little town called Pātea, which is on the southern Taranaki coast. So Dalvanius and the Pātea Māori Club took lyrics written by another Māori woman, turned it into a sort of a traditional Māori pop song, but with a disco-heavy beat called Poi Air. And it, even though no commercial radio station was interested in it, they sort of marketed it themselves. It's sort of an early version of self-marketed product, and it got to number one, and it stayed there, and it got such a lot of attention around the world. They were interviewed on that. You'll know this program, Steve, and I think it's still going. I think a very popular British TV program for kids called Blue Peter.
Know it very well,
well,
yes.
Well, it was featured on that. And as a result of that, the royal family heard about it. And next thing you know, they're invited to perform it at the Royal Command Performance the next year in Scotland. So this little Maori club from a very small little town are sort of international pop stars. And the song won awards here. And it just became synonymous with a new way, perhaps kind of a new way of looking at Maori music. And what's good about this film is that it's telling, as any good documentary does, it tells you several stories at the same time. It tells you about how the song came about, how it was written, how it was made, with not a lot of support from the Pākehā establishment, it has to be said. And that's kind of disappointing to reflect. It doesn't seem that long ago, but to be honest, Steve, what we're talking about is sort of an inherent racism, really. But they just stuck with it, funded it themselves. At one point, I don't want to give too much away, but someone actually mortgages their house to allow things to happen. So it tells you the story of the song and of this chap called Dalvanius, and there's a lot of time about his contribution. It also tells you about what small-town New Zealand life was like, especially in a town like Pātea with a large Māori population. And that was one of the key things I got from the film. I was thinking, you know, here I am living in Auckland City in 2016. I live in a sort of central city area. This is a part of New Zealand life in the provincial areas that there'll be many, many, especially younger New Zealanders, who probably would not have a clue about what this sort of life is like, or that even New Zealanders live this way. It really shows the strengths of Māori cultural life, that everyone chips in together, you know, the bonds of family and community. It shows that very well. It shows the humour very well. It uses a couple of people it comes back to every now and then to as commentators on the story, including Taika Waititi, the director, and Stan Walker, the sort of pop star, and they flit in and out. So it combines a serious message, a serious social message, a particular message about the importance of the Maori language and of it, keeping it alive. That's a really key aspect. And it's incredibly enjoyable. Just a couple of little things I were slightly disappointing to me is Dalvanius Prime himself, this is not a spoiler because he actually died a decade ago, more than a decade ago. And we hear a lot of him from an audio interview. There's no filmed interview that is used. I was aching to see him actually in the flesh to talk about this. I guess it just wasn't available, but it was, you know, it would have been lovely if there had been one that they could have used.
Yes.
And there are a couple of reenactments, one of which worked very well, and another where they have to take you to Sydney to show to reveal what it was like when that Dalvanius performed overseas. And I felt, gosh, was there no footage from taken in Sydney back in the 70s of these guys actually performing? Maybe, I guess there wasn't. But I always feel slightly cheated when there's a reenactment sometimes in docos.
Yes.
Overall, really, really enjoyable. A good combination of a serious documentary, but a very enjoyable one. And it's got a really, really well thought out ending, because I think it, you know, I'm counting myself in this, Steve. I'm a New Zealander. I've grown up in this country. Well, I know there are certain Maori songs that are very well known. If you ask me what they mean in English, I'm not going to be able to tell you. And one of the commentators in the film, Stan Walker, asks a very, very apt question at the end of the film, which the filmmakers answer in a very satisfying way right at the end about the meaning of the words. I won't go any further than that, but it's well done, and big ups to them for that.
Excellent.
Yeah. And now, just my quick segue, drawing two disparate parts of our podcast together. The film shows you two or three musical producers and engineers who made this film. I made the song, produced the song back in 1983, something like that. And one of them I recognised. I thought, where's I seen that guy? And I'd seen him a week or two earlier at the live performance of Miller and his band. Because his name is Phil Yule. He's a sound engineer, and he not only did he engineer Poirier, he's the father of Miller.
Oh, brilliant.
You know, I thought that was a lovely little link between these two pieces of entertainment that we've been considering in our podcast today. So,
New Zealand is not a country so much as it's a rather large village.
Oh, man. And yeah, absolutely. You realise it all the time. As you go through life, you realise it how small it is, even the largest city, Auckland.
And within the entertainment world within New Zealand.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Yes, yeah.
It's quite astonishing.
It wouldn't pay to get on the wrong side of too many people, I suspect.
No. No, because you're never more than about 1 degree of separation away, really, are you?
Yeah. Anyway, so, hey, I think we've covered some really interesting territory today.
There's some good stuff there, yeah.
So, look, we'd better press on and tell you that, again, if you've put your interest, this is Crave. He's Steve McCabe, of course, and I'm not. And we will be back soon with some more music and film. I'm looking forward, Steve, can I just quickly tell you, to the TV series telling the life of another great New Zealander, Sir Edmund Hillary, which is starting on TV One. I think it might even be this week. I will keep an eye on that, and we'll talk about that at some other time, because if you're a New Zealander who grew up here, Steve, the name Hillary is just so much part of your sense of what it is that a New Zealander is. There'll be a lot riding on this, and it'll be interesting to see how they tackle it.
Absolutely. So, listen, before we go, we should have a quick mention of what's coming up very shortly.
Yes.
There's been a couple of interesting concert announcements in the last couple of weeks. Are you familiar with a British band called James?
No, I'm not. I'm sorry.
Oh, they were part of my youth growing up in Manchester. They were from the part of the Manchester scene that was also led by the Smiths and the Stone Roses and Happy Mondays. They were part of that scene, and they're still going strong.
Wow.
They are promoting their 14th album.
Okay.
At the Power Station in Auckland on the 9th of November.
Right. Is that James, as in James?
That's the one,
James.
Yes.
Right. Very good.
You might possibly recognise a couple of their big hits. There was one song called Laid, which was a very, very big breakthrough for them. Their other big hit was a song called Sit Down. But if you're not familiar, get yourself along. It'll be a cracking show. I base this on having seen them in Manchester back in 1990. So I'm assuming that, you know, 25 years on, will still be as good.
Right.
We've also got Simple Minds are going to be coming to Auckland in February of next year.
Okay.
Supported peculiarly, there's an odd mix, but I can't wait to see either of these bands, supported by the B-52s.
Oh. That'll be a good show.
That'll be a fantastic show, won't it? Yeah. So they're playing in Auckland in February. They're also going to be going to a couple of other venues in New Zealand as well. So that's going to be really entertaining. They're going to be playing Vector Arena on the 14th. They're also doing, they just did the one other venue, Horncastle Arena in Christchurch. Absolutely. That's Valentine's Day.
Oh, lovely.
They're going to be in Auckland. And the other one that I'm actually quite delighted to see is Skyscraper Stan.
Oh, he's quite a fan of his.
He's great. I've really enjoyed his music. I've seen him a couple of times live at the Tuning Fork in Auckland. And he's coming back in October. He's going to be playing at the Tuning Fork as part of their Americana Festival, their annual Americana Festival. But he's also doing it a full New Zealand tour.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Getting North and South Islands. And delightfully, their very first date, he's bringing his full band, the Commission Flats, to come over from Melbourne. And their first date is in Pukekohe.
Ah, okay. Well, you can't. You've got no excuse not to go to that then.
I can walk there from my house for that one. So yeah, that's going to be starting Pukekohe 5th of October. 10 days later, they'll be wrapping it up in Dunedin.
Oh, nice. Okay.
So that's going to be fantastic.
Good stuff.
There's some great stuff coming up very shortly. Auckland's the place to be, as always.
As always. Good stuff. Well, I hope you've enjoyed our podcast today. If you want to get in touch with us, we'd really be keen to hear from you. You can email us at podcast@cravepodcast.com.
You can find us on Facebook, or you can follow us on Twitter @CravePodcast.
Of course you can. So, I'm Simon Mercep.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.
Lovely.